Welcome to the Supported Living Property Podcast with your host, me, Lisa Brown, the place to learn about supported living property investing.
In this episode, Sue Baxter talks about supported housing and the law. She discusses license and tenancy agreements. Sue argues that current occupancy agreements are not a good fit for many supported housing tenants, and she shares considerations providers need to think about when setting up tenancy arrangements in supported living.
Hi, Sue. It's great to have you here today. Thank you for joining me. How are you?
I'm good, actually. Yes.
Good. For those who don't know you, do you want to introduce yourselves?
Okay, then. So my name is Sue Baxter, and I am a supported housing, how would I describe myself? A supported housing professional, I probably would say. It sounds a little bit grand, doesn't it? But my background has been working in the field of supported housing for all of my working life.
So, what kind of roles, when you say that, what kind of things have you been doing? So
I started off, I'm going to be giving something away here. I started off back in 1985 working for Mencap. So mainly working in finance, interestingly enough, although my background has been in law, so mainly working in finance. But then I very quickly realised that my passion was housing. So I've worked for a variety of organisations, from very big registered providers like London and Quadrant, Hyde Housing, Metropolitan, Thames Valley, I think they're called now, to working for specialised organisations like Look Ahead Housing that deals with housing people with care and support needs. And I'm working for kind of very small local charities. So, yes.
A whole range of different things. The other thing that you haven't said about your background and that you have behind you, obviously, is that for those who are listening, is that you're also the author of a fabulous book, which I have here. Do you want to tell people about the book?
Okay, then. So the book actually originated, we were doing some work with the Law Commission. So one of my co-authors, so the an original co-author, Helen and I were working, you know, on a piece of work. She worked for the Law Commission. And we were looking at how tenure works in supported housing. And I was saying that for supported housing, it is very difficult because we straddle a lot of different elements of law. And I said, and one of my bugbears is that we can't just pull something off the shelf which says, as a supported housing provider, this is what you need to be aware of with regard to the legal framework within which, you know, kind of we're working. And that started, and we did our very, very first edition. I think I've got our first edition somewhere. And so we did a first edition, which was a much weightier tome, I have to say, because we put everything in there. And I think that was 2007. And recently, and probably very much overdue, we did our second edition, brought it up to date.
So that's called Supported Housing and the Law, isn't it? And it is a really good book to, when you've got questions and bits and pieces to dip in and out of. So yeah, well done for doing that, because it was very much needed, I'm sure.
We were very proud because the I think it was a Community Care magazine actually gave it 5 stars. Fantastic. And said that, you know, the cost of the book was worth, you know, worth 20 minutes of legal advice, etc. So we were actually very proud of that.
Yeah, rightly so. Yeah, absolutely. It is. It's really good, and it's really useful book for anyone who's interested in this space properly, isn't it? To dig into, really. So I know one of your passions is around tenancy and supported housing and supported living. Do you want to kind of talk around some of those issues and help people to understand what they need to be thinking about?
Yeah, of course. And I have to say that is one of my areas of interest was always, how does supported housing fit into the legal framework? and it became quite apparent to me at an early stage, is about the, you know, the fact that there isn't a specific legal framework that is for supported housing. So for our tenancies and licensors, we're operating within a generalist framework. So, you know, when I'm delivering training, often I say I'm going to have a T-shirt made saying don't shoot the messenger, because often it doesn't fit. It doesn't, you know, supported housing with its, you know, we've often got people with who are vulnerable, living in very close proximity with other people who are vulnerable. But what I think is particularly important is that, you know, we educate, you know, I don't think this is just the providers, but I think commissioners and other statutory services about tenancies and licences and the difference between tenancies and licences, because I can guarantee that often what ends up in my inbox at some point is, you know, a provider saying our commissioner would like us to move from tenancies to licences because we're going to be taking people who are at greater risk. We're going to be taking, you know, people with more complex needs. And, you know, having to support that provider, explain to the commissioner, actually there's a legal framework that dictates when a tenancy exists and when a licence exists, and we can't operate outside of that legal framework.
So do you want to explain that? Because I think some people will probably not be very clear about what the difference between a tenancy and a licence is at all.
Okay, then. So I would say the main difference between a tenancy and a licence is that all a licence is a permission for somebody to come onto your land. You know, we grant licences to people when we invite them into our home. And often people will say, well, you don't, you know, where people only stay in a short amount of time, I don't give them a license. And I say, no, actually, you're not giving them something written. You know, if you have a friend to visit, you're not giving them a list of rules and, you know, requiring them to sign anything. But actually, that is all a license is it a permission to somebody to use your land, to, you know, permission to somebody to come onto your land and stay on your land. Whereas with a tenancy, you're actually granting them an interest in that land, and that's an important distinction. But whether or not to grant a license or a tenancy agreement is actually set out in law, and it's actually in case law. We're going back to 1985, Street and Mumford, and you know, in Street and Mumford, it's you know, clear if there are parties to an agreement, if there is a payment, if somebody has exclusive possession. If, you know, kind of, yeah, if those things are present, then it will be a tenancy.
So even if someone had granted a license mm-hmm. on paper, the paperwork said license yeah. all over it, but actually if in effect it is a tenancy, it is a tenancy, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what happened in Street Mumford, because Mr. Street had some desirable properties and said, oh, do you know what? I'm going to rent these out, but I don't want to create a tenancy agreement, so I'm going to put in very big letters license. And the court looked at it and said, well, actually, it doesn't matter what you call an agreement. It's what it's, you know, kind of the characteristics of it that define what it is. And that's when they came up with those characteristics.
Okay, so when would people use a license then? When should they be using licenses, I guess?
Yeah, so I think licenses exist when you're is an expectation in our sector, let's say, there's an mm-hmm. expectation that you are not just providing more than the accommodation, because in supported housing, of course, it's supported housing because we are providing support and in some cases care. But actually, the requirement of that support and care means that you need unrestricted access to that person's property, be it a flat or be it a room in a shared environment. But any point of the night or day, you'd need to access that property to provide that individual with services that they genuinely need.
Okay, so it's not about the length of time that someone's staying there.
That's not... you know, absolutely determinative, get my teeth in. I think that's more, it can be an indicator that it's a very transient arrangement, that that's not regarded as the person's home, But actually, no. What really dictates it is, but you know, kind of, is it clear who the parties are? Is there some payment? Is it, you know, kind of, is it for a period of time, and that payment may be weekly, so that's a period of time. And, you know, has that person got exclusive possession? Have they got a lock on the door? And if they've got a lock on the door, you may still need to go into that room to provide them services that they need.
So if you have someone with quite high care or support needs who needs someone to go in, check on them, provide some personal care, perhaps a couple of times a night, then that actually could be a license rather than a tenancy.
It could be. Mm. What you can do, and providers are, I think, very sensitive around this, where we're trying to give people as many rights as possible. You can give people a tenancy. You can give them more security of tenure. What you can't do is give them less, if that makes sense.
Okay. Because I'm familiar with licenses being used in sort of homeless hostels and those kind of setups, but not so much with people with longer term support needs.
Yeah.
So it's quite interesting just hearing about the difference, you know, the difference there. And then with tenancy, so what, when would you use a tenancy rather than a license, I guess, if you have someone with those higher support needs?
Yeah, so I'd be using a tenancy if you provide the sorts of services where one is that people invite you in and people agree to those services. So people could still have a high support needs and still require, you know, and still be, you know, on a tenancy agreement. I think that because they're inviting you in, they're agreeing to you coming in to their property to provide them with the support and care. But it tends to be where people have got, you know, maybe visiting support, or where people's support is delivered, you know, to a on, you know, kind of on a by a particular arrangement, or I'm just thinking. I would say your start point is you give everybody a tenancy agreement, unless you can feel confident that the you know, that there is a condition that is absent that allows you to give them a license. That's always been my standpoint, because I think particularly with vulnerable people, you give them as much security of tenure as possible.
Mm-hmm. And which is, you have more security, don't you, definitely, if it's a tenancy agreement.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. With a license, much easier to end. There is, you know, you can be more prescriptive with a license, because if you think about the terms of a license, if it's your land and you're allowing somebody to come onto your land, you can be quite prescriptive about that, you know, kind of about that property.
And about the kind of behaviours you'd expect and things like that.
Yeah, and visitors.
Well. Yeah.
That's the other thing. Yeah, visitors, the kind of behaviours, how you expect people to use your property. But when you're giving people a tenancy agreement, you're actually giving them the interest. And one of the most important factors of a tenancy agreement is this covenant of quiet enjoyment. Once the landlord has handed over control, they can't unwarrantedly interfere with that. So they can't bob in and out whenever they choose. So I think that's a ability to exclude people from your property, because it's your property.
And I think sometimes when we're talking about people with quite high support needs, or, you know, with learning disabilities, people forget that actually people have the right. This is their home first. Yeah. In supported living, that's definitely how it should be, isn't it? This should be their home first.
Yeah.
And then they're inviting you in to offer you support, or
So I think that's kind of quite, you know, kind of fundamental for choice and control, is having the tenancy, choosing when you want the support, choosing how you want the support to be delivered to you, and being able to say, I don't want people to come into my property. Or, you know, kind of, there's some instances where you might need to go into somebody's property. And often what you get with supported housing providers, and we have to do this in a way that doesn't interfere with people's covenant quiet enjoyment, is to have in there, we would require access if we have got significant concern about your well-being, or your health, or the you know, health and well-being of somebody else in your property.
And you can put that into the tenancy agreement, can you?
You can, so long as you exercise that very, very carefully and be clear about actually, when would you do that? Because you would be facing, you know, somebody could challenge you and say you've interfered with my covenant of quiet enjoyment. I think it's difficult for supported housing providers because we're walking this tightrope between human rights, duty of care, security of tenure. And, you know, I think it's significant that we, you know, kind of are very mindful of all of those when we're, you know, kind of when we're entering into occupancy agreements with individuals.
I think it's really, really important that people think about them. I think people don't often think about the other issues. They think straightforward, a tenancy agreement, that's fine. And they're not really digging into the details of it, as you're saying, you know, and those conflicting things. Is that what you're saying when you said that it doesn't really fit some of the tenants? Yeah,
absolutely. I think we've got a legal framework that supported housing sits very uncomfortably in.
Right. So do you feel there's an argument for something new, something better?
Well, what was quite interesting is we got involved with the Law Commission is there was actually drafted a rented homes bill, and it was much wider than just supported housing. It was very much about, you know what, a lot of our tenancy, you know, renting arrangements still sit in the law of property, which are some quite antiquated things. For example, this always amuses me. If you're serving a notice, then the common law is you serve the notice on the tenant, his wife or servants. I'm not quite sure how many servants, you know, people in supported housing have. Really, I should imagine. So it went with the butler answering the door. But I think we're sat in this antiquated system, and there was a really, you know, kind of there was a real push to say we should have this sitting more in contract as opposed to the law of property. And but part of this, we were quite excited about, because part of this was we were saying actually supported housing needs its own chapter in this. Mm. And when the draft rented homes bill was produced, supported housing had its own chapter in that, had its own section in that. Fantastic. And that was just amazing. It was like, actually, there is a real recognition that this, you know, supported housing is different to other types of letting.
But did that go anywhere? That
I think it's still sat as a draft bill at the moment. Okay. So
so it's not been completely binned. It's not something that's gone
completely. No, but this was 2006 or 2007. Oh, okay. So I'm assuming that, you know.
What a wasted opportunity. Yeah.
I think it was, actually. I think it's a bit of a shame, really, that didn't go any further.
What things do you think people need to think about when they're setting up tenancy arrangements with maybe people with learning disabilities or mental health problems or in supported housing? If I'm a support provider, what do you think are the things that people maybe overlook?
Yeah, I think one is that, I wouldn't say necessarily this is overlooked, because I've seen some fantastic work, is about accessibility. The difficulty is because you're writing a legally binding agreement between two parties, there is a tendency for it to contain legalese, you know, things that the layperson wouldn't understand. So it's going to be indecipherable if you've got any sort of vulnerability, if you like. So one is, I think, one is we can write those agreements in plain English. Mm-hmm. The other thing is about accessibility. And I've seen some fantastic examples of video explanations of tenancy agreements. I've seen some pictorial examples in plain English. I've had, watched support providers walk people through tenancies and what that means and what kind of rights you have, but also what responsibilities you have. I don't want to marginalise people because they've got support requirements. So I want them to understand what their legal responsibilities are as well as their legal rights. So I think that's quite important. I think it's also, for me, quite important that you have everything you need in the agreement. I often see addendums like house rules. And it's quite interesting because with house rules, I think that I don't think judges know how much weighting to put on house rules. I wouldn't have house rules, because sometimes I've looked at them and sometimes it has things like, you know, what one of them is, you know, kind of please leave the toilet as you'd wish to find it. And then sat right next to that is do not bring weapons onto the property. And I've been like, what? And I think if it's serious, it goes in the agreement.
So not to have addendums with lots of stuff, just alter the agreement and add it all in.
All in the agreement. Yeah, of course, you're going to be having something about what services you may provide or a furniture. Mm. But actually, if you're looking at, you know, the kind of things which is, you know, which I mentioned before, leave the toilet, you find it, or take, you know, kind of make sure you clear up after yourself. That's the kind of thing that we'd all do if we lived in our own home. We'd agree between ourselves.
Mm, mm.
So I think kind of good neighbour agreements are far more valuable and have more status with the people who are living in supported housing. Yeah.
So putting them actually into the things, not having pages and pages of addendums at the end is a really good takeaway.
Yeah. Well, particularly if it is something really serious.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually you have that in your agreement. Mm. Or just, you know, kind of when you're explaining to people, you reference, say if you've got something about antisocial behaviour, actually reference what antisocial behaviour looks like for that particular property.
Brilliant. And make it really clear and really accessible for everybody.
Oh, accessibility is a key. I mean, I've read agreements, and as I said, I had a background in law before I came into housing, and I've read agreements and I haven't understood them, and sometimes because they've been cut and pasted. The other thing is make sure your terms are fair.
I think what do you mean by that?
I've seen agreements that say no alcohol, and it hasn't been a scheme for people who are, you know, recovering from alcohol or substance misuse, but you know, and the providers often say, well, the difficulty is that, you know, kind of the behavior, and then I say, but then have something in about behavior, because people can, you know, kind of behave impeccably after having had a drink, and some people can behave in a way that's antisocial without drinking at all. That's so actually don't have terms in there that are unfair.
That makes perfect sense. That's great. Sue, thank you. It's been really good chatting to you today. We'll put the links to the book in the show notes if anyone's interested in it. But thank you for joining me. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for having me.